This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the AIPIS show for accredited income property investment specialists and those who aspire to be. If you're a real estate, mortgage, or financial professional, this is the place for you. We'll explore innovative investment analysis, sales, marketing, and income-generating strategies for the most historically proven wealth creator, income property. Learn from the experts as they show you how to build a better business and a better life.
It's my pleasure to welcome Chris Porter to the show. He is the Chief Demographer and Vice President with John Burns Real Estate Consulting. They're based in my former hometown of Orange County, California, and they do a lot of great studies, sell a lot of their data and their work and their consulting to big real estate developers, and I believe institutional apartment owners as well. And we're going to take a deep dive into some demographic issues and what they mean for real estate investors, what they mean for the overall housing market, what they mean for landlords. And in talking to Chris just a little bit before we started recording, we talked about my thesis that the next 10 years coming at the rental housing market, or the demographics coming at the rental housing market, are nothing short of phenomenal. Chris actually agrees with that, and we're going to get a little more insight into that. We've talked about it before many times about Generation Y liking mobility, delaying household formation, being saddled with student loan debt, and on and on and on. So we'll dive into that and some other topics. We'll talk a little bit about Generation Z, which is just coming of age here soon, and some other great stuff. Chris, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Jason. I appreciate it.
Good. Hey, it's great to have you on the line. And, you know, you're out with a new book called Big Shifts Ahead, Demographic Clarity, for business and real estate people. What are some of the broad strokes, you know, in your book that you cover?
Well, we just decided several years ago, just do a real deep dive into census data, make sense of a lot of the mounds of data that's out there that often conflicts with each other, and we really want to help our clients understand what's going on from a demographics perspective. Some of the big takeaways from our book, we look at the impact that women have had in the economy and specifically on the housing industry as well, the immigrant population. We've also looked at older and younger workers today, as well as what does the retirement picture look like over the next 10 years as well. We're about to see a 38% increase in the number of people who are 65 years and older, and that's a huge jump, and we're just really curious to see what happens over the next 10 years. And so that's what really led us to write this book.
Interesting. Well, 65 and older, I almost feel like you should say 65 years young. I mean, that's so young nowadays. People, you know, it's crazy that that's still considered retirement age in today's world.
You're exactly right. And in fact, a greater share of them are working than ever before.
Oh, of course.
You'd have to go back to the early part of the 1900s to see people 65 plus working this much. You're right. It's definitely a younger, quote unquote, retiree, and they've got a longer retirement to finance than ever before. And so they want to. A lot of them are staying active in the workforce for that very reason. One of the great comparisons I like to look at is when you look at pictures of presidents today, and then you look at pictures of presidents when they left office, 50, 60 years ago. It's a much different, more youthful person today. For sure.
No question about it. But being president ages you. You know, all of them go in without gray hair and come out with gray hair.
That's a great point.
You know, I think that's a pretty stressful job overall. But hey, I'd take it. So where should we start here? I mean, you divide generations up by decade, which is quite interesting. I think that puts a little bit of a finer point on the generations. But, you know, maybe before we dive into that, can you just say a few words about Generation Z? Maybe, first of all, is that the official name of that generation, that demographic cohort that is coming after Generation Y, or what's known as the millennial generation? Are they going to be officially dubbed Generation Z?
So that's a great question. And in fact, I mean, part of the reason we decided to look at this generation by decade born was people have a hard time defining the generations. what is Gen Y? And I think the conventional definition is about born 1980 to maybe 2000, which would make Gen Z, I don't know, starting in 2001. And again, that could vary by depending on who you ask. So if you think about people who are born in 2001, they're still 16 years old. They're a sophomore in high school. It's hard to really know what their adult lifestyle is going to be like yet. So that was one of the reasons we decided to go with this different approach and really, put a finer point on the generation definitions.
Right. And I think it's good because people don't know exactly where they start and end. Even demographers disagree. You know, how old are you to be a baby boomer or a Gen Xer or a Gen Y? So tell us about that. I mean, you go way back to the 1930s. And you call them savers, and in the 40s, achievers, and the 50s, innovators, and then equalers in the 60s, and balancers in the 70s, and sharers in the 80s, and connectors in the 90s, and globals in the 2000s. What does all that mean?
Sure. So let me take this a step back. And as we talked about earlier, you know, we all hear anecdotes at cocktail parties about things that are really rooted in demographics. It's usually based on somebody's personal experience. You know, my kids are doing this, or my parents are doing this, and that's what they say the boomers are doing, or that's what the millennials are doing. We want to put some real numbers behind those anecdotes, just really to equip business leaders to make great decisions, help them make great decisions. So we created this framework where it was based on the decade born. So if you look at the baby boomers, and I think it's widely accepted that they're born from 1946 to 1964. But if you look at somebody who's born in 1964, they've had a very different life experience than somebody born in 1946. And same thing for the millennials, as I mentioned. If you talk about somebody born in 1980, who's a 37-year-old father of two, married and owns a home, that's much different than somebody born in 2000, who would also be considered a millennial and is a junior in high school. You can't really paint those two groups with the same brush, given just the life stage they're in. So we said, let's look at this with a finer point. We realize there's still some generalization that occurs here, but we think it's a process that's a little bit more digestible, looking at it by decade born, which actually gives you really nice 10-year increments to look at, and it makes the analysis that much easier. So as you pointed out, we gave each group a nickname, and we based those nicknames based on a shift that we saw that particular group leading. Now, we think other groups have exhibited a lot of these same trends or exhibited these same shifts, but really these were the groups that led them. And we wanted it to be a name that was had a positive connotation to it and something that generation would be proud of. So we called the 1930s group the Savers, just based on their upbringing. I mean, they were born into the Depression era, and for them, sort of frugality was the way of life. And it's something that's carried through onto their adult life. They worked hard and they saved a lot. The 1940s achievers, this was the group that, you know, the first half was pre-baby boom. The second half of that decade was just the very beginning of the baby boom. And what it did is it created a very competitive group. More of them were, you know, there were more people than ever fighting for a spot in college or fighting for a job once they graduated college or graduated high school. So by nature, they just became a very competitive group. And so they led us, our country, in sort of this achievement, striving philosophy. The 1950s, we call the innovators. That's the generation that includes Steve Jobs and Bill Gates. So if you think of sort of about their high school classmates, that's the group we're talking about. And really, those are the innovators that have created a lot of the tech companies, a lot of the technological advances that our country benefits from today. The 1960s group we call the equalers, and that was one of the actually more challenging groups for us to come up with a name for. We decided on the name equaler because they've really benefited from a lot of the movement toward equality that has been started by generations prior to them. But they were the ones, for example, that women started graduating college at the same rate or even higher rate than men did. And while we're not at complete equality yet, whether it be, you know, gender or race, we really see this group as sort of the one being at the forefront of helping to lead some of these trends towards greater equality. The 1970s group we call the balancers, and this is another one that we struggled with the name for. We don't want to imply by any means that this is a lazy generation. I know that sort of the 1970s group has often come across as being maybe slackers or they're associated with Gen X. But really, it was a group that we saw creating more of a balance between their work and life. They saw their parents, the 1940s achievers, the 1950s innovators, who worked very, very hard and sacrificed for that. They also had higher divorce rates as a result. They were working so hard. This 1970s balancer group, we think that they work hard at finding a good balance in their life. And that's sort of a shift that they've led. And, you know, we've seen a number of trends reverse with this group. And so I think part of that is just due to the fact that they were seeking out more balance in their lives. The 1980s shares, that would include a group that, you know, would include Mark Zuckerberg, for example. Any of these young Silicon Valley tech executives, this is a group that basically their lives are about sharing. They, you know, share things on their social media accounts, but they're also sharing homes with their parents at a greater rate than prior generations had, just because they haven't moved out. They're sharing cars via Uber. They're sharing just so much. And so they're leading us as a society towards more of a sharing type society.
The sharing economy.
Big yes, impact. Exactly. Yeah. The 1990s group we call the Connectors, this is a group that's just been connected to technology ever since the day they were born. And I think back to the early 1990s, when the internet and the World Wide Web was really becoming part of our everyday lives. This is a group that they were young kids when that started out. And so they didn't know a life that only has internet access. And they really don't know much privacy as a result. They're very highly educated group, and more so than any generation before them as well. But as you pointed out, as part of our earlier conversation, they're graduating from college with more student debt than ever before. And then the last group is the 2000 Globals. And this is a group that just is growing up with multicultural friends and value diversity. We don't know a whole lot about them yet, as they're still very young.
This is Gen Z, the Globals.
Yeah, you would call them exactly Gen Z. But technology has definitely been a big part of their education to date. And, you know, we do expect they're going to be big in numbers, and we expect that they're going to have a big impact on our society. Over the next 10 years, this is the group that's going to be starting to form households. You know, by 2025, the oldest of them will be 25 years old. So,
right. Yeah. Okay, interesting. So do kids sort of hold the same values as their parents? Because you can sort of look at that echo. Or do they go the opposite way of their parents? And the reason I ask you this is when you look at the 1970s balancers, you talked about who their parents were, or maybe it was another cohort. I think it was the balancers. Well, you talked about the achievers and the innovators, right? They worked very hard in those years, and the balancers were a little more slacky. You didn't want to say that, but you kind of alluded to it. You know?
They sought to find more balance, I guess we could say.
Yeah, right. Does the echo of the parent, do they go the opposite way, or do they go the same way, or does it depend? It probably depends.
It does depend. I mean, I think maybe early on in their lives, they kind of rebel a little bit and want to go the opposite way. I mean, one of the theories that's been out there, the philosophies out there, has been that, you know, you're more likely to behave like your grandparents' generation. So you kind of rebel from your parents, and you're more like your grandparents. And if that's the case, then these 1990 connectors are probably closer to their 1930s savers grandparents. And there's this idea that, yes, the 90s connectors are a little bit more fiscally conservative. I mean, they were the ones that sort of came of age during the Great Depression, the Great Recession. And, you know, they went through a lot of the same things that maybe their grandparents went through in the Great Depression.
Yeah, so maybe they're not into conspicuous consumption like the, you know, some other generations. Okay, well, tie this all into the real estate market and the you know, the home ownership market and the rental market. I mean, what can we learn from this?
Sure. Well, our thesis is that, you know, over the last 8 or 9 years, just as we've gone through that recession and emerged from it, we've really not seen household formation expand at the rate that it has historically. I mean, we historically have done, you know, 1 million to 1.2 million households per year. We were doing about half that level for 8 or 9 years. Part of that is recession-oriented, but we think, gosh, the demographics are so strong. There's a lot of pent-up demand for forming households over the next decade or so, both from the groups that delayed household formation due to the recession, but also the groups that are starting to become of age now. So we think there's some really strong points for strong household formation over the next year, or excuse me, over the next 10 years.
I think over the next 10 years. And I think the other big point to that, and I believe you may have addressed this in your newsletters at one time or another, and that is the shadow demand for housing. And it's, and what that is, you know, the Gen Y kid living at home who's, you know, 27 years old or maybe older even, and they're still living at home. And eventually you assume these children are going to get out and make a life of their own. I hope so. But there's a lot of those. I mean, are there any solid numbers on how big that shadow housing demand number might be? Because I think that's going to be huge for the real estate market, both in rental and ownership categories.
We do. And actually, we've quantified it in our book. One of the things that we've looked at, it, though, is, you know, this 1980s group. So those would be people who are in their mid-20s to mid-30s today. They've, for the most part, formed most of the households that they're going to form. But they are not yet necessarily all homeowners. I mean, they're buying homes at a later point in their life than they were the previous generations would. So what we're thinking is that group, well, there's not as much of the shadow demand from them. There's the shadow demand for home ownership for them going forward. They formed households. Now they're going to actually buy homes. So yeah, we've quantified a lot of that in our book. Our best estimates put about 12.5 million net households formed over the next decade. And that's a net number. So it's the households that we're forming, minus the households that are going away. And I think that's one thing that people tend to overlook is, you know, is the first wave of the baby boomers, or, you know, our 1940s achievers, are reaching an age where they're going to start to pass away. We're going to have more deaths in this country than we've ever had, and we're going to start to see more households go away as well. So our net number is about 12.
But the number is a net number of 12, what do you say, 12.5 million new households in the next 10 years?
That's right.
Okay. And is that an immigration-adjusted number? I mean, how much of that is new immigration versus just the existing population forming households?
Or sure. Do so you that, know? That does include our immigration forecast as well. You know, over the last decade, immigration has helped to fuel one-third of the population growth in the United States. And based on the latest numbers from the census, they're expecting that, again, one-third of the population growth in the U.S. over the next decade is going to be as a result of immigration. Now, we'll see what happens. You know, now that we have a change in administration, we don't know what's going to happen. But at least as of the last forecast from the Census Bureau, they're saying it's still really strong immigration.
Then overall, would it be fair to say that you guys at John Burns Real Estate Consulting are pretty bullish on the real estate market? Or what do you think? I mean, you know, and please let the political side of it enter in. You know, what do you think Trump's impact will be on that? I mean, he is our first real estate president.
That's right. That's a good
that's
point.
Kind of interesting, you know? Yeah.
Well, from a demographics perspective, we think it's really strong. As I mentioned, you know, much stronger household formation than we've seen. I think, as we talked about earlier, I think home ownership will actually continue to drop. It's going to drop at a slower pace, but that's partially just a demographic. So it's a math issue. You've got a larger number of...
Tell us about that, because sure. I've always said that I think, and nobody in real estate agrees with me on this, but I think, and maybe I'm, you know, like the Antichrist saying this for my industry, they probably hate me, but I think that the real home ownership rate should be about 55%. I think it should go down. You know, I mean, home ownership is overrated, if you ask me, but go ahead. I think owning a lot of investment properties is underrated. I think that's wonderful, but owning your own home is overrated. I mean, the convenience of and flexibility of being a renter is a really powerful thing, you know, but go ahead.
Sure. So I'll talk about that in just a minute, but we're not calling for anything that's draconian. It's 55% home ownership. But
you think that's draconian?
We think it's going to fall by below 61% over the next 10 years. And that's part of that is just a math equation. It's you've got a larger number of older people passing away who are 80% homeowners. and you've got a large number of young people coming in who are largely renters. And so the math just kind of works out that way. We also just think people are going to be less likely to own than prior generations at the same age. One of the things that, and this kind of goes to what you're talking about, is the single-family rental home has really emerged as a great alternative for people. People who want to be in a home, they want a yard, they want to be in a good school district, maybe they have kids, and so that's really important to them, but they can't come up with the down payment, and they can't meet the monthly mortgage costs, or just really the down payment is a huge obstacle for people. And so the single-family rental home, well, it's been around forever. It's been institutionalized here in the last several years and garnered a lot of press attention as a result. But it's really a great alternative for people who just want to be in a detached home.
I couldn't agree more. And I think as for the investor side of that equation, it's the most historically proven asset class in the world. You know, for the small investor, for the regular person, you know, just get yourself a few rental homes and you're going to be doing great. You know, I mean, they got to make sense. They got to be in the right markets, et cetera. But yeah. Okay.
And I think, you know, one of the things, it's hard to remember this sometimes, especially like where I live in Southern California, that if you look at all the renters in the country, a third of the renters in the U.S. are renting a single family home. And you don't necessarily see it that way here in Orange County, where you've got a lot of apartments. But there are parts of the country where, you know, if you look at the middle of the country, there are counties where 50% of people are renting 50% of renters are renting a detached home.
Yeah, right. Just like markets like Memphis are like that. So, and we've done a lot of business there. But I agree. I mean, it's Orange County, and you know, I lived there for many, many years. That's a very expensive market, and you're not going to find a lot of, well, as many at least, owners wanting to rent those expensive homes because they don't make any sense from a rent to value ratio perspective for the investor. You know, you've got Irvine Apartment Communities, which is one of the biggest landlords in the country, and tons of apartments there. But yeah, you're saying the renters like renting single family homes. Do you want to divide this up into geographical areas at all for our listeners, or you know, what else do you want us to know?
Sure. So there's two ways I could tackle that. One would be just talking about geographies as well. So, you know, we see this migration out of the Northeast, out of the Midwest, as you've got older populations who are wanting to be in warmer climates. You know, I think that the southern economies are offering more incentive for businesses to move there as well. And this is not anything new. We've seen this happening for a long time. But as we sort of look at the next 10 years, we think that the South, so including the Southeast, including Texas, and some of the Southwest areas, you know, we think they're poised to grab about 62% of the household growth over the next decade. Now, right now, they've...
Yeah, I agree. But you know what the problem is? Is that, like, we've been doing business in those markets for a long time now, and the prices they've adjusted pretty significantly. A lot of those markets are getting a little bit expensive for investors. You know, when you look at a market like Dallas, Atlanta, Austin, I mean, markets that we've done hundreds of transactions in these markets, and they're expensive. I mean, you know, they're not like Southern California, but they're not really cheap like they used to be.
No, they're not. But I think people are just, I think part of it is due to aging the population. They want to be in warmer climates, but I also think affordability, relative affordability is another big driver there as well. And so they're home to 44% of households today, but we think they're going to capture 62% of growth going forward. The other thing that we tackled in our book as well was just talking about this whole urban, suburban, rural discussion. And
great point. Yeah. Tell us about that.
There's a lot of confusion over that as well. And I think, again, it comes down to definitions. And somebody says, well, all the millennials are moving urban, and all the, you know, people in their 30s and 40s are moving suburban, or they're not moving suburban, you know, and what are the retirees going to do? I think part of that comes down to how do you define urban, how do you define suburban and rural? And so we set out to create some definitions that we thought make sense. You can disagree with our definitions, but what we did is we calc the numbers based on how we defined it, and really we've seen this urban pop here in the last 5-10 years. It was partially jobs driven. People just wanted to be closer to job centers. That's where the jobs are being created. But also, you just had this pop in the young adult population, people in their 20s, who do desire to live in more urban-type environments. And even had, you know, a big pop in empty nesters, some of whom would move urban. And so I think both of those factors contributed to the sort of urban pop during the last decade or so. But as that younger household starts to have kids, they get married, they want to have good schools for their kids, they are going to start suburban migration that always happens. It's just happening at a delayed rate for them. So, you know, we're forecasting, based on the way that we define these areas, urban's going to capture about 15% of the growth going forward over the next 10 years. It's higher than historically, but it's slower than maybe this last 10 years. But we think the suburbs, that's going to be almost 80% of the growth going forward.
Okay, so I got to ask you about a prediction I've been making.
Sure.
I am predicting, now we've seen over the past, I'm going to say 20 years, there's been a pretty big movement toward like revitalizing urban cores, you know, turning these downtown areas into kind of swanky walkable areas that, you know, everybody loves this type of stuff. But they're fairly expensive, you know, I mean, the land values are still high and, you know, rehabbing old lofts and so forth, that's not cheap to do that stuff, or building a new high-rise condo complex or apartment complex. But I think I am predicting the resurgence of the suburbs, the good old suburbs, and my major reason for that is the self-driving car. Are you guys thinking about autonomous vehicles and how that's going to change real estate? And let me tell you why I think that. Look, at real estate, since the beginning of time, since the caveman days, has been about three things. You know what I'm going to say? Location, 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 right?
Right.
And location is still meaningful. I'm not saying it's not. That will never change. But I'm just saying it's less meaningful than it's ever been in human history because of technology and, you know, virtual this, virtual that, just simple things like Skype and email and so forth and computer technology on your desktop and, you know, at the coffee shop. But the self-driving car that, you know, and then when you combine that with its natural component of the sharing economy of making the self-driving vehicle an Uber, Lyft type arrangement where you don't even have to own a car, that gets pretty powerful. I mean, does it really matter if I got to go 30 minutes to get where I want, if I don't have to drive, you know, if I can just sit there and be a passenger, take a nap, you know, work on my laptop, whatever, exercise, you know, maybe I could do yoga in the car. I don't know. the whole thing's just going to change if you ask me.
Yeah. It's going to be really fascinating to watch how that plays out. I will say though, you know, I don't have a necessary opinion on the driverless car, but I do think you're right that we're going to see some more, you know, much more suburban growth. But I think that, and this is our philosophy, is that we're going to bring some of the qualities that we like about urban into the suburbs. And so we're going to create more small, walkable downtowns and otherwise suburban areas.
Right.
And they've
it's interesting that they've done that a little bit. You see it in Ladera Ranch in Orange County, by the way, you know, there's these little sort of mini downtown areas that are, you know, they're pretty cute, you know, and I like that. That I hope that catches on more so.
And so we've came up with a term to describe this. Traditionally, it's been referred to as mixed use, and that doesn't really roll off the tongue great. So we came up with this term we call suburban, and it's the idea of bringing the best of the urban qualities to a traditionally suburban environment. So it's walkable downtowns in suburban areas where people, you might not have to have a car during the week, but you probably want a car during the weekends to, you know, to get out of town or that sort of thing. So yeah, the suburban area, we think it's a term that we're really hoping is going to catch on, and I think it really describes that concept very well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think suburban is really cool. That's good. Okay, wrap it up for us and just share anything else you want us to know. This is a very interesting conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I could really talk for hours about this when we filled a book, and we probably could fill two or three more books based just on what we found. It's just a fascinating thing because there are certain things about demographics that are predictable. I know 1 year from now I'm going to be a year older than I was today. And I know, you know, what's the likelihood I'm going to pass away in the next year. So there's some elements of this that are predictable. But you throw in things like government policy and the state of the economy and innovations in technology, and it can totally change those predictions. So we really wrote this to help stay on top of demographic trends. It's something we want to continuously be updating, really to help us just understand what's the consumer going to be doing next, and how can we, as business people, really capitalize and make great opportunities out of that.
I think that is fascinating. The website is realestateconsulting.com. Of course, the book is available on all the usual places online and so forth.
Right, and we actually have a website, bigshiftsahead.com.
Oh, just that for has the all book. The okay, good.
Information about the book. We've even got a free chapter you can download, and all of our charts in our book are available for download for anybody who buys the book. So if you find you really enjoy it, you can take a closer look at the charts as a download.
Excellent. Good stuff. Chris Porter, John Burns Real Estate Consulting, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jason.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own. And if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.